Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and I host the show. Before I start, I'm actually going to apologize to my guests and to you, the listeners, because I have a very bad cold. So sometime during the interview, I may start to cough, and if I do, my guest, I hopefully will just keep on talking right through it so everything will run smoothly. So I'm going to bring him on right away. His name is Matt Nash. So, Nash, welcome to the show.
Hi, Nancy. I guess I won't ask you how you're doing since you just told us.
Yeah, I'm okay. Just every now and then I get this tickle, you know, it comes from the chest. So if I start to cough, just please keep right on talking like I don't exist. How's that?
I'll try that, yeah.
All right, that'll be good. Nash, let's talk a little bit about who you are, okay? And then we'll get into your book and some questions. But first, let's give a little bio to the listeners about who Nash really is and where he came from.
Sure, yeah. I essentially grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. I went to Virginia Tech. I joined the Marine Corps, did a few years with them, jumped into a career in sort of corporate America in basically the IT field for about 20 years, and then went on my own in 2005. And in that time period, had a mixture of federal government and commercial clients, and mainly my role was to be a change sort of transition leader type whose focus was on assisting people with communications and IT and understanding what's involved in making change. Not too long after that, I was inspired by a companion of mine to consider, you know, putting together a book, and I think that's probably why you and I are talking now, Nancy.
That's probably true. But even with that, Nancy, I have a couple of questions for you. You know, you talk about working with the government. Now, there are some people out there who really would not like to work with the government, but apparently you don't mind working with the government. So when you work with them, and I know you work with them because you're trying to help them, which everybody needs help, do they take what you say to them or, you know, some of the ideas that you give them, do they take them or do they kind of like bulk up them a little bit?
Well, you know, I don't ever have the expectation that with whomever I work with that, you know, anything I advise will be followed, you know, to the letter. The spirit of the advice I give is usually conceptual. It's usually sort of a general direction or a general, you know, suggested path. And it's consistently, oriented around establishing clarity with the client. Usually a client is struggling with, some sort of a, you know, planning that they're involved in or strategic development. My role is typically to get them to get all on the same page, basically. And so the federal government is a wonderful client in the sense that they are surprisingly open to that kind of input. But, you know, of course, they've got their agenda and they've got their politics. And the key is for anyone really working with them is to be very clear that you know, that's just part of the process. It doesn't have to be demonized, and they don't either.
Mm-hmm. I think it'd be real important to be very unbiased if you're going to work with the government, you know, for several reasons, but one of them being because, you know, they have, of course, the Democrats, they have the Republicans, and they're all kind of there together, and they usually don't see eye to eye. So I think being unbiased would probably be very helpful. Did you find that to be true?
Absolutely. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's just... Personally, I don't have an interest in taking a side, except for the side of a peace, if there is such a side. But basically, my goal is in every encounter to work with wherever a client sees themselves, whether it's an individual client or a commercial or federal government client, just, you know, kind of work with them from where they are and helping them to get to where they want to be.
And I think that's pretty important. Now, let's talk a little bit about your book, How to Be Right About Everything. That's quite a title, okay?
You like that title?
Yeah, I like that title. You know, people are going to look at that book and go, what? That guy must be totally out of his mind. Always right. So how did you come up with that title?
Well, the title actually was, the original title I pitched to my partner, Kay, was, you know, How to Be Wrong About Everything. And she just kind of chuckled and said, you know, that's cute, but I would never buy that book. And I said, what would you buy? And she said, well, I would buy How to Be Right About Everything. And just a little background, she and I had really looked into creating a book about relationships and peace and how to catalyze that about a year prior, and we really didn't have a good framework at the time. for how to put that together. And then when she posed that question to me, you know, can you write a book titled How to Be Right About Everything? I thought, my gosh, that's so obnoxious. Not her suggestion, but just the title. I mean, the ego is going to react to that in such a, you know, revolted sort of way. So I sat down for a couple of days and really genuinely asked myself, can you answer that question, Nash, in a way that's meaningful, supportive, helpful, and not contesting to actually any, where, in other words, where my response does not make anyone else wrong. I came up with an answer and thought, you know what, I got a framework here, and about 3 weeks later I had a book.
That's good. And actually the rest of the title is An Awakening Journey into Unlearning, which I also found interesting too, because everybody thinks that they want to learn, and this title here, this part of it, to me it's very important that people unlearn a lot of the things that have been taught to them so they can actually relearn the truth. And yet people have a very hard time letting go of a lot of things that they have been told as children all the way up to adulthood, even though they know in their heart they may not be the right things that they were told. So, I mean, you know, the book title and everything sounds, you know, very interesting. Now, it's a series of books. So there are, by a series, there's going to be more than just the one volume. So how many volumes do you have?
You know, that's an excellent question. My editor is convinced I've got about 20. I'm working on two right now. It should be done by March. I'm not sure yet, Nancy. It's kind of just sort of flowing right now. Part of it's driven by the types of questions I get. Some people, you know, it kind of depends on where they're at and where their mind is, what sorts of issues are coming up. I try to make all the topics I discuss socially relevant, things we would recognize, we encounter on a daily basis.
Why do you think people, Nash, have such a hard time getting out of their own way?
A commitment to seeing their interpretations of their life as sort of facts in their mind. That is the short answer to that question. When a person, as you said beautifully earlier, you know, people sort of take a storyline about their life and kind of hold on to it. That holding on, you might compare that to putting a wall around your face. You know, just sort of blocking you from actually seeing down the road in front of you, seeing the people you're supposed to be meeting. This is sort of, some people call this living in the past, but essentially what it is you're just so committed to your personal stories about who you are, that's really where you're living. It taints how you see the present moment, and it also prevents you from even thinking clearly about any kind of future context.
Do you think, Nash, that a lot of the teachings that people like yourself and a lot of the things that I do actually would work better if we started with children and then worked our way up to adults so that they actually start off kind of in a much better scenario rather than starting off where they are and then as they grow have to relearn everything, basically?
Well, ideally, for sure. You're absolutely right. But, you know, I also don't want to take hope away from anyone at any age in their life. Awareness really is a choice. It's something we can at any time make. You can actually be, you know, 65 years old and have the attitude of a 15-year-old. Innocence is available to anyone at any age. It's really not chronologically based. But yes, I wholeheartedly agree with you. I think that, that'd be wonderful to focus on children, but I wouldn't give up on the older folks either though.
No, you can't give up on the older ones. But you know, I find it really interesting because most people that I talk with, you know, they always talk about helping the adults change. And it's kind of like, you know, they say you can't teach an old dog new tricks, which we all know isn't true. It's kind of the mindset that the person may have, because you're going to meet people, just like I have met people, who are so stubborn and so set in their ways that you're going to have to work with them for a long, long time for them to even change a tiny, tiny bit of their beliefs. You know, and so to me, without taking the innocence away of children, you know, I think a lot of the teachings that are actually going on for the adults now could really start with the children first, not first, but start with the children, you know, also as the adults, so that we all get to the same level. Because right now, when I look at the children and I look at adults, they're actually in two different planes here, you know. And it would be good if the children and the adults could, you know, maybe agree upon many things, and, you know, not just freedom or whatever, but just in general. And I'm not seeing it, you know. I look at a lot of the teenagers today, and they're having this very, very hard time because their energy is so different than adults' energies are. And yet they're made to fit in to, you know, a lot of scenarios that they in their heart know are not true. And yet we are expecting the children to do that.
Yeah, I hear you. And, you know, and I guess I would say the same thing to a child or a teenager as I would to an adult, which is, you know, you're picking the path that you're walking down. You're actually choosing that path. And I think that puts everybody in the equal driver's seat, so to speak. You know, they're all quite capable of choosing to see commonalities with each other if they want, mm-hmm. or to see differences if they want. And, you know, what we've learned, at least certainly what I've learned, is if you amplify or focus and amplify on differences between you and the other, whether it's an age gap or it's a gender gap or a racial gap, whatever it is you're choosing to focus on, the inevitable conclusion of that kind of a focus is more separation.
Mm-hmm. I do have a couple questions for you, Nash, and, you know, and not just for kids or adults, but a lot of the people right now are very, very worried about everything. How do you help the people get out of their worry spot?
Well, I'm sorry, I'm hearing a little echo on the line.
Do you want me to repeat it?
No, I think I understood your question. It just threw me off, my own voice coming right after me. The short answer to your question is, you know, worry itself is a choice, not a fact. This is something that I adhere to and teach repeatedly, which is, you know, you choose to be in a mindset that says, I am very concerned. You also have the choice, and people make this regularly, to choose to be, you know, more positive, more optimistic, about any moment you're in. And so I would caution people for two things. First, I'd say, you know, first you got a choice. Let's get real clear on that. This is not a fact that you have to be worried. It is a choice. And then number two, you know, take on what's in front of you as opposed to what you imagine might be in front of you. And in this sort of way, center yourself upon the moment you're in, limiting how much you're focused on either the past or the future, because those are going to be tainted by whatever it was that was driving you to those worries to begin with.
And I know that it's a choice. And a lot of people don't think it's a choice because they've been in it for so long that they don't know any other way to do it. So while I go grab my cell phone real quick, could you maybe explain to listeners some of the techniques that you might use to help people, you know, refocus so that it's not a constant worry in the negative? See, I'm a very firm believer that if you're going to worry, it's real important if you worry positive, not negative.
That's good, Nancy. I like that. Yes, I'll attempt to answer your question the way you'd like. The strategy that I recommend is it's sort of non-religious. It's very secular in terms of the lingo I use in my text and specifically, and that is, I offer a discernment between facts and choices. And as I emphasized a second ago, worry is a choice. Well, if you're going to choose that, you're going to have consequences. So if you like the consequences, my suggestion is stay worried. If you're not happy with the consequences, then my suggestion is open your mind. Essentially, you can equate, and be very gentle with yourself as you're listening to my words, you can equate being worried as having a closed mind. And when you have a closed mind, you're not going to be able to hear your own voice, let alone the voice of others. So the worry state in and of itself will actually block you. So you're going to have to take a break from that for a moment or two or 10. If you've got 10 minutes in your life you can spare without worry, then my suggestion is you recognize where it's occurring. It's occurring in your thoughts. And place worry itself in the proper context. And that's basically what I do in my text, is I divide the world into two ways of seeing. One are facts and one are choices. And there's nothing wrong with a choice. If you want to worry, I encourage you to worry. But recognize that that choice will present an experiential outcome, you know, stress or depression or anything you name, that you might not want. And so, you know, short answer is you're choosing that. You can choose to see any circumstance you're presently in or could be in from a different perspective. But it takes a little training. It takes a little patience with yourself to begin to recognize what is actually a fact and what's a choice. And, again, that's the kind of thing I teach, helping people understand what perceptions will open their minds and lead them into a different seeing altogether, and what perceptions will consistently close the mind. Closed mind means you can't be reached. Open mind means you can be, and there's a whole other world out there if you want to see it. Does that help?
Yeah, it does. Now, in your book, I did not get the opportunity to read your book, but I just read like a couple books and stuff about it. And in your book, there's some myths that you would like to kind of change a little bit for people, kind of upend it. What are some of them in your book?
Well, the primary one is the importance of false perceptions, also known as choices. I'll give you an example. The ego, for example. We often talk about the ego, but we don't. What I do in the book is really put the ego in perspective so that people can learn to interact with their life and the people in their life differently. I'll give you an example. Humans cannot own each other. Humans are actually equal to each other. There is an inherent equality as a fact of existence. And this is sort of a generalization, but that's intentional. There are healthy forms of generalization. So what the book will do is it will take the term general, the concept generalization, it'll say, you know what, it's all right to generalize. If you're generalizing towards facts that open your mind, I think if you ask yourself honestly, anyone listening, if you really enjoy feeling inferior or superior to another person, you probably will answer, you know, I don't really enjoy that, if you're honest. Some people actually prefer that, and that's fine, too. I don't personally want to feel either of those things. I don't want to believe that about myself. So a belief which consistently returns the experience of peace is that we are equal. So that's one of those myths that we upend in the book, is we talk about all of the ways in which the ego and perception justifies the seeing of inequality, the seeing of levels and labels and categorizations and, you know, different types of ways we organize the world. These kinds of things actually block us from learning.
Yeah, and I agree. You have a website. So let's give out your website so people can check it out and, you know, because you have a lot of good information on there, actually. So why don't you give that out to the listeners?
Oh, you bet. Thanks, Nancy. It's howtoberightabouteverything.com.
Okay, which is, again, people are going to go, how to be right about everything? Wish I knew how to do that.
Well, like I said, the idea is not to be right at someone else's expense. It's actually learning to be right with yourself. And at peace with yourself. When you're at peace with yourself, when you've forgiven yourself, when you've cut yourself loose and given yourself a break and said, you know what, I'm all right, your tendency to be able to do that for others is enormous. And watch how your world changes when that happens.
Mm-hmm. A lot of times when I'm doing counseling, you know, I always ask people, you know, do you like yourself? And they hesitate with that. It's like, what? Do I like myself? It's like, yeah. Can you actually look in a mirror and go, I like me? You know, I love me. I love who I am inside. Not what you look like, not what you have, not your material stuff, but you. Because, you see, if you can do that, you're going to get along with people all the time. You know, because you're not trying to make yourself look better. You're not trying to, you know, fit in, like what you're saying. You know, you're not trying to major up to everybody else's idea of who you are supposed to be. And so, to me, it's very important that people know, you know, individually how much they like themselves and love themselves so that then they can portray that outwardly. And then, yes, I would agree, there's a world of change there because everybody gets to see it through a different total perspective, a happier one, one that's like, oh, my God, is that person going to like me? Or, you know, maybe they're not going to like me. You know, they don't have all those questions going on. And it's real important, I think, that people just learn how to like themselves, love themselves. To me, that's one of the first biggest steps that people can take in order to find out, you know, all about themselves. Because, like I said, most people can't do that and mean it, you know. So that's one of the things that I have people try to learn how to do after we've done a session also, is to get them to look in that mirror and go, I like me, I love me. And, you know that feeling of it's okay to be who you are, you know. So your book probably goes along with some of the same things that when I'm doing the counseling, I work with people in a little different way, but nevertheless, it's all got the same meanings to it. Now, you also have another website. It's Emergent Awareness. Do you have?
Yes, that's correct. Emergent, okay. E-M-E-R-G-E-N-T, awareness.com. And that's the site that, you know, where I can be accessed. I can actually be accessed by either site, but yeah, the book site was the previous one I mentioned, and this site is a site that has our businesses together.
Now, part of your stuff, I would think, and I'm going to throw it out to you, and you can yay it or nay it, is actually healing different parts of a person. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, again, that term is one of those beautifully generalizable terms. The healing that we are involved in is essentially moving anyone to a point of clarity in their mind. So, you know, they come into a picture that doesn't look clear. It's uncomfortable. Their relationship is difficult. Could be work, at home, family. The picture looks cloudy. There's some distrust maybe going on. Our work is about sort of centering the mind and helping people get very clear on distinguishing between facts and choices. And believing only the facts, and sort of, you know, once you understand what it is you're choosing, you can comfortably detach a little bit and create some distance. And actually, I think you said it beautifully, Nancy, just a second ago. It really is, the coaching here really is about those identity thoughts. You can't tell somebody this is who you are, but you certainly can help them recognize all the ways that they can't see who they are. So that they can voluntarily let go of those ways. And then, of course, you know, find out that, you know, they're their own best teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, Nash, if people just had probably a little bit more self-confidence, not ego, because that's totally different than self-confidence.
Right.
But if they just had a little bit more self-confidence within themselves and a little bit more security within themselves, I think it also make a big difference as to how quickly they can, you know, make some changes or open themselves up for better awareness or, you know, better healing, whatever word you might choose. But it's that inner part of a person that most of the time people have a hard time with. So they want to go outside and they want to seek somebody else's opinion and they want somebody else's advice because a lot of people don't have enough securities within themselves to think that they can do this. So part of your coaching, I'm sure, is helping people to get very secure within themselves. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. The goal is to obsolesce the need for any coach, any healer, any teacher. It, you know, again, that can take time, and that's fine. But it also doesn't have to. It really depends on the person and their sort of openness, their willingness to stay open, and their willingness to kind of cut themselves a break a little bit. You know, I mean, the ego teaches us to voluntarily beat the crap out of ourselves, pardon my language, but it really does. It teaches us to constantly grade ourselves, and usually it's not a good grade. It's usually a negative grade, and And even the positive grades I don't trust. I would rather not be in the business of grading at all and just kind of recognize that there is a me that exists apart from the grades. Who's fine, who's stable, who's certain, who's okay. And that's the place that we, you know, again, like I said, I can tell you that, but unless you experience it for yourself, which is what the coaching is all about, you really won't have a good reason to believe it. And so we sort of coach towards recognizing all the ways that that core identity that is stable and certain and peaceful is currently blocked from your personal awareness. And so when you go, hey, wait a minute, my God, I didn't even realize I did this. You stop doing it voluntarily, and then you find yourself to look a little different in the mirror. You find people look a little different to you, too.
Now, your coaching sessions, they're done by phone?
They're done by phone. They're done in person, whatever a person's comfortable with. I also use Skype.
If it's done by phone, you know, you're talking, is it like a half-hour talk, is it an hour talk? How long do you spend with them for each session?
Well, typically they run about 1 hour to 90 minutes, depending on the situation, depending on the commitment. I usually can share what I have to share in about that amount of time. And sometimes just repeat sessions are necessary. We've had a few clients where, you know, it has as many as 4 or 5 sessions, and then the person was really able to just kind of heal themselves from that point on. That's always my goal, is to kind of get them into a place where they recognize how to use these techniques for their own self-healing. But, of course, I'm willing to work with anybody as long as they need.
Do you find that a lot of people have a really rough time taking the responsibility to make some of the changes? Because, see, in mine, when my counsel is going on, people have a very hard time with the fact of responsibility. They want to blame it on somebody else, for example, or they want to give excuses why it can't be like that. Do you find that when you're talking with people?
Well, that's usually the fastest way they filter themselves out of the process. And I'll tell them that, you know, and I'll be gentle, of course, and I'll say, you know, that's fine if you want to believe that. The experiential consequence of blaming someone else is you will not grow. You won't. You will not learn. You will not grow. It's a false sort of picture you're seeing. And I do understand the need to do that. I get it. It just has a consequence, and that's all. And, you know, some prefer that consequence. Temporarily, they don't want to grow. They want to stay in the same spot, angry or hurt, you know, lamenting, might even be vengeful. But again, my answer in every case is absolutely identical. If you're happy with the consequence of that belief, stick with it. If you're not, then you got to open your mind, and we'll work together to get you to a new place.
And that's a good question, because I asked them that too. Do you want to stay where you're at? You know,
yeah.
I'm probably a little bit more blunt than you are, but sometimes I find that it has to be done like that. And I don't mean to be mean or cruel or anything. It's just that sometimes they need a little jolt in order to go, well, no, I'm not happy where I am. You mean there could be someplace else I could be that would make me happier? And then you get that little instant where they kind of hold back and go, that means I got to work. It's like, well, yeah, nobody's going to fix you. Nobody's going to do it for you. It's really important that you do it for you. And so it's kind of fun, because I play a lot of words with people to get them to open up and wake up, you know, because I'm a very firm believer that people have everything inside of them that they need. It's just bringing it out, excuse me, so they can accept it and believe in it themselves. Excuse me, without, you know, constantly searching, because my goal is try to get people not to come back and see me.
Right.
I know it sounds weird, but it is, you know, and I know there's a lot of other, you know, counselors out there who that's not their choice. It's like, see me, see me, see me. But mine, and it sounds like yours also, is to try to get them not to have to come back and see me. Is that what you try to do too?
Absolutely. I'm on the same page with you. I, you know, the goal is empowerment, full empowerment. And when they're fully empowered, they don't need me. And they have discovered their own teacher, and they like that person, and that person is them.
Mm-hmm. See, and a lot of my coworkers go, Nancy, what are you trying to do? Get out of business? It's like, no, it's actually a compliment when they don't come back, because it means that they've listened, that they've done their work, and they really like themselves now. So there's no reason to come back until, you know, whenever. But again, a lot of people don't understand that because it's like, well, they got to see me. They got to see me. It's like, no, they don't. The idea is to help them, to re-empower them, to let them be all they can be as quickly as they can be. And that's going to help them more than anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, some people have a little different idea of that. Now, you also do relationship healing for singles and couples. So do you use the same techniques when you're working with a couple versus with a single?
Yes. Actually, the techniques are identical. When couples are interacting with me, they're going to, of course, sort of imagine the dynamic between the two of them and kind of place that picture in front of me. And say, you know, this is what I see, and this is what we see, Nash. They'll start with the we see, and then, of course, the I see is going to be just a slightly different between each person, and therein lies the conflict. But what I'll do is I'll push back in a gentle way and say, hey, okay, you're going to each own your own perception, and you're also going to recognize that your own perception is leading you to the particular conflict you're seeing. And again, this is, you know, you touched on it earlier. This is the willingness to not be a victim anymore. This is the willingness to sort of stand up and say, you know what, I am owning my own perception. I really am choosing to perceive what I choose. And when you can do that, when you've, you know, it takes a little courage, but you'll actually discover you're a heck of a lot stronger. And like you said, you already have the tools. The tools will actually start showing up for you almost immediately when you do make that choice. But while you're insistent that there's some, you know, thing called a relationship dynamic, or there's some other party that's responsible for your moods or your emotions, you will not see the tools that you do have to move forward.
How important, Nash, do you think it is to have pre-marriage counseling?
I'd say it's, you know, I'm really reticent to make general statements sometimes, but I think it's smart to take the time to get aware of what your goals are, how being married might serve those goals, what it is you're really going for with that whole idea. You know, I've had those kinds of dialogues, and I've also had post-marriage dialogues, where one, I'll give you an example, was one couple that they had been divorced for some time, and there was a child in the mix, and there was a lot of conflict between the new wife and the friend, the person I was coaching. Massive amounts of conflict, and I'm not going to paint the picture because I think anyone can imagine what conflict looks like. But I coached the person through the scenario by essentially dismantling her false perceptions, exposing them to her first. And it took a little time, took several months. And then from there, once she was clear that these are things she's consistently choosing and consistently bringing the conflict to herself, and, you know, don't worry about the ex-husband, just focus on herself, she started to realize, wow, I'm really debilitating this relationship. And this was in the beginning enormously difficult for her. Very difficult, because she was insistent on blaming the other party. Once she stepped out of that paradigm and said, you know what, I'm to blame. You know, I'm to blame for my own personal feelings, my own personal experiences I'm having. She was able to, you know, through some visualization we worked through, completely upend the relationship in a positive way. I mean, the entire scenario she had with her ex-husband, the son in the mix, and the new wife for the ex-husband completely changed. I mean, I'm talking about going from hate conversations to hugs and kisses and how can we work together kind of thing. I mean, it just, it blew her mind away, but it was really in her perspective all along.
Mm-hmm. How important is visualization?
Extremely important. I would say well, what we're talking about when we say visualization is we are talking about those identity thoughts. What we're talking about is who you think you are, and or who what you think you are, and who what you think everyone and everything else is in relationship to you. And this is not a small deal. This is the heart of it. This is the cause. I don't, you know, teach people new behavior because behavior is experience. I have a real simple formula that I use, Nancy. It's thoughts equal cause and experience equals effect. And if you really want to heal or change your life, you're going to deal with cause, which is your thoughts. If you want to sort of spin in circles, you're going to deal with effect. You're going to try to solve the symptoms or alter your behavior. Well, your behavior will do absolutely nothing. You will just have the same experience. It might change its form, but the experience will repeat. It might even change its form in such a way that you don't even recognize that it's the same problem. But in fact, it's the same problem. You must deal, if you really want to make a real change that's lasting, with your identity thoughts. So visualization, again, this is down the road. Once we've exposed and dismantled the false perceptions, the visualization can be extremely handy in helping you sort of internally discipline your mind to accept the new reality the reality.
Mm-hmm. Have you had the opportunity to work with, I love this one, with a family that are newly married with kids and have ex influences all over the place? Have you worked with? And how did you help that to get kind of where it needed to be? Because that's one of the biggest things when I'm doing a lot of counseling. People go, well, my ex, blah, 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 blah. It's like, yeah, well, so why are you buying into it or why are you feeding into it? You know, but how do you work with that, Nash?
Yeah, it's a great question, Nancy, because I know that does come up quite a bit. What I emphasize is, in each person who makes those kinds of statements, is a recognition that the statement itself is a block for the person. Why? Because it places, they're actually, by making a statement like that, well, this person's doing this and that person's doing that, what they're basically doing is giving their power, their personal power, to the other person. They're actually disempowering or weakening themselves with such a statement. Someone asked me the other day about the media. Well, how can you not see the media as evil, Nash? Well, if I saw the media as evil and hurting me or taking away my ability to be calm or clear, then I've just given the media all that power. It's really quite simple. So if you're going to go and blame your ex-spouse for a scenario that you're having, that's fine. Go ahead and do that. It will actually not bring you the peace you're looking for or the cooperation with that ex-spouse. These are blocks you're holding in your mind that are actually preventing the relationship from unfolding the way it's supposed to.
How important is the clarity?
Absolutely critical. It's pivotal and it's important. This is the point upon which my clients come to me. They're looking for, how do I get to this place, Nash, where I'm not wrestling down effect anymore. I'm really just dealing with cause. And this is, that's one of the points of clarity we talk about. First we get, cause and effect in the right order. And then once they're in the right order, we address cause, which is, again, going back to your example of the new family with all the external divorces and other relationships and other children in the picture. Who you think you are and who you think everyone and everything else is in relationship to you, this is the thought you need to focus on. This is it. This is where all of the problems come from, or all the healing, all the peace. It's right there in that one thought. If it's closed, if it's contained, you're going to have closed, contained, limited relationships. If it's open and opening, you're going to have positive, serendipitous, rather beautiful experiences with people that might have been former enemies.
which would really be important, I think, especially when it comes to families, because it tears kids apart. And I have a very big thing about kids, as you already can tell just by some of the things I've said, because they're caught in the middle 99% of the time. They can't do too much about anything, but yet they're used as pawns. And I have a very big problem with that, because it isn't fair. It isn't fair to the child especially, and it isn't fair to either one of the parents, because they're not taking the responsibility. Give out the name of your book again, Nash, and your websites so they can go there and where they can get your book from.
You bet. Thanks, Nancy. The book is How to Be Right About Everything, and the website where that book can be found is howtoberightabouteverything.com, and I can be reached at emergentawareness.com. That's E-M-E-R-G-E-N-T, awareness.com.
Okay, now do you have a Facebook site or anything else that people can go to?
I do. I'm on Facebook. You bet. In fact, there's a... excuse me, one second. I've got a cough now. There is a Facebook group called How to Be Right About Everything, which actually is growing right now. We've just noticed a little surge these last few days, but it's growing. A lot of the writing from Book 2 is being published there. I've got some excerpts from Book 1 that are there, too. And so that's available. If you just go to look for that group, How to Be Right About Everything, you'll find the book and us.
That's good, Ina. Your book talks about peace. How does your book help promote the peace?
Well, you're probably going to find this repetitive, Nancy, but peace is available when you see all the ways and let go of all the ways you've actually blocked yourself from experiencing it. The baseline assumption I make, and I make this with my corporate clients, I make this with my individual clients, is that, you know, we talked about clarity earlier. Clarity is already here. We just need to clear the muck off the window so we can see it. Same thing with peace. Peace is actually the natural state. It's already here. We expose and dismantle all the ways we've blocked ourselves from experiencing it. And that's, in a nutshell, that's when we sort of marry ourselves to our perceptions, you know, our stories of our past, our commitments to our future panic or future worry or, you know, who knows what else is going on. Those things block us from recognizing that peace is actually right here, right now, available right to us at the moment.
Now, we've mostly talked about individual Nash, but also do corporates. So what, when you go into a corporation, what is your main focus with the corporation?
You know, each corporation comes to me with a different, you know, challenge, and they vary considerably. One might have a goal of changing itself as an organization from one particular focus to another. Another might have a financial goal. They might, you know, I'd like to cut our costs down or how we're spending money over the next few years. So it really does vary. But what is common with the corporate clients is that they're looking for some sort of a change and insight into how their current way of viewing themselves is actually going to block themselves from making that change. So what we do is we coach to help the corporations or groups or teams, any individual, find that clarity that position that basically says, okay, these are the attitudes, these are the current obstacles that will derail your efforts, that will block you from getting to where you want to go. And here are ways we can actually dismantle these blocks so that you can get to where you want to be. I had one client that literally one corporate client, major corporate client, asked me to help them understand why they can't change as an organization. That was it. It had lots of efforts to bring about change internally and millions of dollars spent and just couldn't recognize or realize the changes that they wanted. And, you know, my role with that organization was to kind of help them recognize why that's the case and how it doesn't have to be the case moving into the future.
Nash, why do you think... Now, see, because when I was a kid, we'll start there. When I was a kid, you know, corporations used to be nice to their employees. They used to want to help them. They used to want to make sure they were okay. And all of a sudden, it did a 360-degree turn. And it's like, you know, so you're an employee, so what? You know, we can get them their dime a dozen. What, Nash, do you think made that change with corporations?
Well, it probably is an overemphasis on the nature of competition itself. I think that, you know, competitive forces, when you're sort of seeing competition as your world, it constricts your viewpoint. When you see cooperation as your world, and you know, I know this stuff sounds hokey. I'm clear on that. I've had a lot of experiences that have suggested to me, personal experiences, and through clients, that it's not hokey. That if you really can recognize that how you see the world translates into how you experience the world, and some people, for them, it's a no-brainer. They get it. They're like, you know what? I understand. That's how I live every day. But, yeah, there's an audience out there, and some of them are in the corporate world, that don't get that. They only see it one way, and they fashion their actions based on that particular seeing. Competition is a fact, Nash. It's not a choice. Well, okay, that's fine. How do you feel living in that perspective? Do you feel productive? Do you feel your teams that you're managing are productive? Well, no, they're actually kind of frustrated now. Actually, they're stressed out. We're losing people. Attrition is high. Okay. Is it at all possible that there are other ways of seeing this picture? I mean, if a client, whether it's a corporation or an individual, can concede on that one point, that there's more than just their perception, we have a door opening. And when that door is open, then of course we, you know, guide them to picking an alternative seeing that is more in alignment with their goals. Because clearly seeing competition as a fact, not a choice, is, you know, causing them personally to get stressed beyond belief. And of course, causing the conditions that the team there, you know, that they're managing, if it's a center, or how they see their peers, all of those are, you know, sort of, there's a big veil over their eyes. They cannot interact with these people properly because they're confused and they don't know what day tomorrow is going to look like.
Yeah, well, in today's economy, there's it's kind of a very narrow view on what's going to be happening the next day.
That's right.
Give out the name of your book and your websites and your face page again for people, please.
You bet. It's excuse me, How to Be Right About Everything. That's the book, and that's available at howtoberightabouteverything.com. It's also available on Amazon and several online retailers as well. The website where I can be reached is emergent, E-M-E-R-G-E-N-T, awareness.com.
And then you're on Facebook.
Yes, I'm sorry, you're right. And we're on Facebook as well, personally and as a group. And again, the group is How to Be Right About Everything. That's it, just the book's title.
Believe it or not, our time is just about up. But I do have one more question I find kind of interesting. And you did used to have a bed and breakfast in Las Vegas, but now you don't really run it as a bed and breakfast. You have it for friends, but you don't charge for that. So how do you keep it running?
Well, it's, you know what, we were, that's a great question. We were sort of faced with a little conundrum here in Las Vegas. Kay and I really do enjoy meeting new people. And, this is about. It's not about, an income. This is certainly not enough to make any money from. So it really is about friends and, you know, friends come and, you know, become our friends, so to speak, online and come and stay with us when they're here in Las Vegas. It's a lot of fun. We have a good time.
I'm going to have to come out and visit you. I live in New Mexico. I'm only 8 hours away.
Definitely. Yeah, let's make that happen, Nancy. That sounds like fun.
I have to come there anyway.
Okay.
So I'll figure out what date I'm going to come, and I'll see if you guys are available, and, you know, maybe we'll get together when I come out there. Now, Nash, I have one other question. You know, we talked about you, but you also have a partner, and we didn't talk about her. So can you just give us a little bit of history about your partner before we're going to go off the air?
Just briefly, because she's really a brilliant but silent partner, and that's how she prefers it. So I'll tell you that she's, this is available on the website at featherdance.com. She's basically she lived in Alaska for about 40 years of her life. And I would characterize Kay as brilliant, intelligent, fun, very peace-oriented, and just a gentle, loving soul. That's my partner.
Good. It's always good to have a partner like that.
Yeah, I'm grateful. I really am.
Now, just before we're almost out of time, so Nash, one more time, give out the name of your book and where they can get it, please.
Okay. The name of the book is How to Be Right About Everything, and it can be purchased at howtobeRightAboutEverything.com or Amazon or Barnes & Noble online, other store. It's also available in Kindle and ebook versions. Our website is emergentawareness.com. Thanks a lot, Nancy.
When is your next book coming out?
I'm targeting March. It's just about done. We're vetting some of the material right now on Facebook at that group I mentioned earlier, the How to Be Right About Everything group. But, it's more in this same series of thinking, this unlearning process, and we're really excited about it.
And do you have a name for that one?
It's at the moment, it's How to Be Right About Everything, Volume 2. The first one is Volume 1.
That was an easy one. Nash, it's been great talking with you. I'm very flattered that you took the time out of your busy schedule to, you know, have a few words. And hopefully a lot of people probably will go get your book, because it sounds like it's one great book that most people, according to what I do, could probably use and benefit by. So hopefully, you know, we got it out there so people know that it is, it's existent, and then people can find out more about you.
Thanks, Nancy. It's been my pleasure to speak with you as well.
You're very welcome. You take care. I'd like to thank you, all listeners, and again, sorry about some of the phone stuff going on and my voice, but may God bless all of you. I really hope that your Turkey Day was a great one. Take care of each other and especially yourself, and may God bless all of you and take care. Bye now.